You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Michael Bloomberg has announced that New York City public schools are getting about $600 million less in funding from the state, and it will result in fewer teachers. As state and city officials make their final decisions about budget cuts, they might take a little time out to examine the efficacy of programs that actually improve children's achievement. And they might start with a new book by Richard E. Nisbet called Intelligence and How to Get It, Why Schools and Cultures Count. It outlines strategies that don't cost much but have a big impact. It's published by Norton, and I'm very pleased that it brings Richard Nisbet to the show today. Hello.
Hi.
You say for years the findings put forth by psychologists Herrnstein and Murray in their controversial book, The Bell Curve, have shaped policy. Didn't their research claim that there was a strong relationship between genes and intelligence?
Yes, it did. The book had several themes. One is that IQ, intelligence, is largely heritable, primarily a matter of genes. Second is that partly because of this, family background matters very little. The family backgrounds, the environments that are created by one family versus another make very little difference to intelligence.
You mean an enriched childhood will not really affect IQ?
That's very much the implication of the book. Schools also make very little difference. Basically, intelligence is just something that unfolds in any kind of normal environment.
Well, that doesn't seem logical. How did they determine that genes were the sole factor in determining intelligence?
Well, they were writing on a large literature that looks at the determinants of intelligence. And there were just some errors that were made by people in the field of intelligence. For example, they were able to show that the correlation, the association between the IQs of two identical twins raised in separate environments was very high. Well, they say, well, if it's separate environments, the environment's not making them similar. It must be only their genes. But in fact, it turns out that identical twins who are raised in one environment versus another tend to be very similar in those environments. That is, for example, identical twins tend to be raised often in the same town, sometimes by relatives, often go to the same schools. And if you actually look at identical twins who are raised in very different environments, they don't resemble each other nearly as much.
I remember the bell curve being very controversial and discredited by a lot of people. So why has it had such an impact?
Well, it was certainly contradicted by a lot of people. I think that in the opinion of many, if not most, psychologists, the conclusions were accepted. In the opinion of many people who make public policy, the opinions were accepted. They weren't happy about it. Psychologists weren't happy about it. The general public wasn't happy about it. But I think it was largely accepted, although it certainly was contradicted.
So what about your research? What relationship did you find between genes and IQ?
Well, first of all, I find that there are some errors that were made in the calculation of IQ. Two very important errors are because there isn't that much of a close association between the IQs of adoptive parents, that is, parents who adopt kids, and the kid's IQ, the conclusion is that, well, the environment's not making much difference. But that's a huge error. It turns out that if you look at the IQ of a kid who's born to lower-class parents, welfare, unskilled worker, and so on, and you either have that kid adopted by a lower-class family or by an upper-middle-class family, the difference that makes to IQ is 15 points. It's absolutely
huge.
That's a lot. It's huge. It's the difference between graduating from high school without much distinction versus, in all probability, going on to college and having a shot at professional or graduate school.
In your chapter, Varieties of Intelligence, you write that there are actually two components to G, or general intelligence. One is fluid intelligence, and the other is crystallized intelligence. What's the difference between the two, and how is each measured?
Crystallized intelligence is what you know, and what you know about how to do things. So it's vocabulary, it's comprehension of the way the world works, it's arithmetic, which are learned procedures for doing certain kinds of problems. And fluid intelligence doesn't rest so much on what you know, including what you know about how to do things. It's sort of raw brain power, the ability to solve abstract problems on the fly without drawing on general knowledge so much.
And we don't, in the past, when we measured IQ, we didn't make those distinctions?
Oh, it's been made for quite a while. It's although people such as the authors of the bell curve tend to regard them as very much the same sort of thing, and fluid intelligence essentially is the best possible measure of overall intelligence.
We got a comment on our show page from Anne from Manhattan. She said, I'm in Mensa, and being brainy has certainly helped me get ahead in life, but social intelligence, learning to temper my brainiac ego, work with difficult people, and be a good listener has helped me the most. We need ways to evaluate and recognize other kinds of intelligence, common sense, creative problem solving, cultural sensitivity, social intelligence, etc.
Right. Well, I agree. Aside from these two very important aspects of what I would call analytic intelligence, that is crystallized intelligence and fluid intelligence, there are emotional intelligence, as she says, social intelligence. There's pragmatic intelligence or practical intelligence. You know, I work with very smart people. I work with graduate students. They all have high IQs, but some of them are not so good at figuring out how to do experiments, how to be successful in their career. Those are the ones who have practical intelligence, which is, in my view, and in the view of some researchers, as important as analytic intelligence. And, of course, creativity is also important.
Aren't there a wide range of IQ tests these days? There used to just be the one.
Right. Well, there have always been IQ tests that had lots of different subtests. So there's vocabulary, there's arithmetic, there's puzzle solving, there's mazes, there's short-term memory tests on them. So those are that kind of subtests on general IQ tests have been around for a long time. Tests of pragmatic intelligence and tests of creativity are relatively recent.
Well, when I was a kid, it was the Stanford-Binet test. And then people started complaining that they were culturally biased and there were other problems. And so adjustments were made.
Right. Adjustments were made?
There were some developed that had that try to get rid of the cultural biases, for example.
Yeah, I don't think you can do it. I don't think there's such a thing as a culture-free intelligence test. In fact, that's one of the things that it comes out clearest in my book is it turns out that there's been a huge increase in IQ over the last 60 years. In fact, probably, although we're not so sure about that, over the last 90 years.
An increase in IQ.
Absolutely.
So we're getting smarter. I remember years ago people said that we were going to get dumber as the gene pool was deteriorating.
Right. Well, that's one of the claims in the bell curve. It's clear that's wrong. Actually, it could never have been very true, even because if you take out of a population the very brightest people and don't allow them to reproduce, fortunately, that experiment's never been done and won't be, but if you did that and you looked at the next generation's IQ, it would only be down about a point. So you can't have, by reproduction rates, it could never have really affected IQ all that much. But in fact, IQ scores have been going up hugely, and this is one reflection of the fact that culture is tremendously important to intelligence.
What exactly are IQ scores supposed to predict?
Well, they're supposed to predict, for one thing, if IQ scores didn't predict our understanding of how intelligent someone is, you wouldn't believe in them much. But in fact, if you look at how ordinary people rank order the intelligence of other people, that correlates fairly well with IQ tests. So IQ tests are definitely capturing something that people understand about intelligence. The other thing that they're intended to predict, and this is why they were created, the Binet that you mentioned is a French psychologist around the turn of the 20th century who invented IQ tests. And the primary reason that he wanted to have such a thing was in order to be able to predict intelligence of school performance of ordinary kids, and especially to identify kids who are going to have trouble in school, kids who might be retarded. So it's intended to predict school performance, and it's also intended to predict performance on the job. And people give IQ tests to see how well people are going to do on their work.
My guest is Richard E. Nisbett, professor of psychology at the University of Michigan. He's currently based in New York City at the Russell Sage Foundation. His book, Intelligence and How to Get It, Why Schools and Cultures Count, is published by Norton. And as a result of IQ tests, we've segregated kids. We've put kids with certain IQs, similar IQs, together in classes. Has that been an effective way of teaching?
Well, actually, that's quite controversial right now, whether it's a good idea to segregate kids in terms of their ability. Even if you don't segregate kids in terms of their ability, I'm very sympathetic with the plight of the very bright kid in an ordinary classroom.
Bored out of his mind.
Bored, because you can do with things that cost little or nothing. You can improve that kid's situation, give him harder arithmetic problems to work, or give advanced reading so it's a more interesting text for the kid to deal with. So you can do a lot with very bright kids, even if you don't segregate them off.
In your section on motivation and achievement, you write that toddlers who delay gratification have higher scores on their SATs and tend to do better in school. What are some examples of toddler or child in general delayed gratification?
Well, there's an extremely interesting study that was started about 35 or 40 years ago by a psychologist here in New York named Walter Mischel. He was at Stanford at the time, and he looked at kids in the Stanford Nursery School, all of whom were very bright, you understand. These were bright kids. And he did very clever experiments where he said to the kid, I'm going to have to leave for a minute, and there's a cookie there on the table. Whenever you want, you can have that cookie. But if you wait till I get back, you can have two cookies. And how long a kid can wait is termed the kid's ability to delay gratification. And it turns out that the longer kids could wait for that second cookie before they ate anything, the higher their SAT scores were 20 years later. And the same thing turns out to be true for kids in a working class neighborhood in the Bronx. And these kids who were not so talented as the kids at the Stanford Nursery School, again, when they tested in later life, they had higher IQs.
Is there something that parents can do to help develop patience in their children?
We don't really know, but I suspect you can teach delay of gratification to a kid. You can say, well, you can do this now, or if you wait a little while, you can do this other more attractive thing.
But I guess the bigger question is, why are these patient children better able to deal with studying, stress, and focus, and all those other things as they get older?
Well, if you can say, well, I'd like to go out and play with the other kids now, that would be fun, but I got to get this homework done. That kind of trait is going to stand you in good stead the rest of your life.
So it's simply doing your homework. Oh, boy, no wonder I did so poorly in school. How does SAT compare to IQ tests as a predictor of success in school?
Well, there's an interesting thing about SAT scores. People in the IQ business have tended to treat SAT scores, some of the mathematical and verbal on SAT scores, as just another IQ test. And it is highly correlated with IQ. But we've come to know recently that there is an ethnic difference in how well kids do on the SAT scores as compared to how well they do on IQ tests. A lot of people think that Asian kids are brighter than white kids in general. Turns out their actual IQ scores, if you look at people who came to this country before the 1968 immigration laws, those kids' IQs, those Asian kids' IQ, were no higher than those of whites. But if you looked at their SAT scores, they were substantially higher than white kids' IQ. And the way you get a high score on SAT, especially on the math test, for example, is by working very hard. And Asian kids work very hard. That's why they do better on the SATs, even though they're not actually brighter in a genetic sense. And that's why they do very well in occupations later. As a matter of fact...
And by the way, aren't the SATs supposed to evaluate that sort of thing and the ability for a kid to do well in college?
Yes. I think they here I'm getting a little bit out of my element, but I think probably SAT scores do a little bit better in predicting performance in college than IQ scores do.
My guest is Richard E. Nisbett, N-I-S-B-E-T-T, a distinguished university professor at the University of Michigan. He's written numerous books on intelligence and culture, cultural psychology, a member of the National Academy of Sciences. His latest book, Intelligence and How to Get It, Why Schools and Cultures Count, is published by Norton. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Richard E. Nisbett, his latest book, Intelligence and How to Get It, Why Schools and Cultures Count. It's published by Norton. You had an op-ed piece in Sunday's New York Times in which you made the case that money allotted to public schools should be spent on programs that will improve achievement. Some of the programs you mentioned in your piece as having limited value are ones that have historically been given the most money. Head Start?
Right.
I always thought Head Start was a great success.
Head Start is a great success for some of the things it was set up for. It was actually never really set up in order to teach kids to be smarter. That was not the primary goal. It was concerned primarily with their health and welfare. And from that standpoint, it's very successful. The mortality rate of kids in Head Start has dropped to the level of the population at large. That's a big achievement.
But it didn't give them a leg up with all the kids who came from households where there was a lot of cultural activity, all the other things that they had been deprived of?
No, it doesn't have much effect. It has a little bit of effect on intelligence of kids so that when they enter kindergarten, they're somewhat brighter, but that begins to fade. Now, of course, part of the reason it fades is these kids are typically going back to probably poor home environments on average, not all, but on average, and they're going back to worse schools almost universally. So in a way, it's no surprise that it drops down.
What about whole school interventions in which teams of education engineers come into a school with a new design for the curriculum and more teacher training?
In general, those are not very successful, and they tend to be pretty expensive. There are lots of programs like that. I respect them, but it's not a lot of bang for the buck.
So let's get back to Head Start. What about pre-K? Are there ways of making pre-K more successful?
There are several programs over the years that show that you can in fact make kids brighter, and especially you can hugely improve their academic achievement in later grades.
And one of the programs that you cite is the Perry Preschool, set up in Ypsilanti, Michigan in the early 1960s. What did they do?
Well, first of all, they had very well-qualified teachers. They were well-trained. They were highly motivated. They had good teacher-student ratios, one teacher to six kids, and they actually focused a lot on intellectual matters. I mean, Head Start, you know, it's often tired women, just like mom is tired, who are just basically doing high-level babysitting. If you actually try to work with kids, intelligence, focus on those kinds of things that are going to make them brighter, it's effective.
James Heckman, a Nobel Prize-winning economist at the University of Chicago, has estimated that for every dollar spent on a pre-K program like Perry, $8 has been gained in higher incomes for participants and in savings on the cost of extra schooling, crime, welfare, all sorts of other things.
That's right.
So are we being penny wise and pound foolish
that's
in the way we spend our money?
That's what I think. I think actually, Heckman points out that $8 return for every one is about the same as a 17% on investment, and it's hard to beat that.
So why haven't more people been convinced of this sort of thing?
Honestly, I don't know. The data have been out there for quite a while. There are several programs like Perry that are extremely effective.
You mentioned Knowledge is the Knowledge is Power program. Is that
right?
Called KIPP?
KIPP, right. That's a program that's only a few years old. It works with middle school kids. They start them in the fifth grade and go up through the eighth grade. And these are not like any other ordinary school, whether for deprived kids, which these all are, or for even kids who are in upper middle class settings. or let's put it this way, they're about as good as what you might expect to get in an upper middle class setting. They start school at 5:30 in the morning. They go till 5 o'clock in the afternoon. They go every other Saturday for a half day. They go 3 weeks further into the summer. And it's not just drill and kill, as the education folks say. It's basically an upper middle class kind of experience. They get sports, museums, theater, musical instruments, and it's a very well-rounded education, and it results in big gains in math and reading skills.
So you're saying basically that most kids start off pretty equal. You know, there are genetic differences, but they start off pretty equally. And it's the ones who work hard and the ones who get higher IQs, not just excel in life?
Well, actually, I do think kids, they don't come into the world with the same genetic makeup. There is a contribution of genetics. There's no question about that. But then the kind of stimulation that a kid gets, both in the home and in school and in neighborhoods from peers and so on, all have a big impact on how smart kids turn out to be.
You keep on talking about math and such, but one listener wants to know if creativity is a form of intelligence.
Well, I certainly think creativity is a form of intelligence. Coming back to those graduate students I was talking about, there's the brilliant analytic kid who's just, you know, put a book chapter in front of them, and they'll really go to town on it, making extremely interesting, valuable comments. Another kid who's maybe not so analytically brilliant but has got plenty of pragmatic intelligence. And then there are kids who not so stand out for either attribute, but who are highly creative. I mean, they may come up with a lot of bad ideas, but every now and then they come up with a doozy that really is very valuable and that you can pursue with the kid.
My guest is Richard E. Nisbet, who is Distinguished University Professor of Psychology at the University of Michigan, author of any number of books, the most recent, the one we're discussing, Intelligence and How to Get It, Why Schools and Cultures Count, published by Norton. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Some of the other studies that you cite are surprising. For example, the findings of social psychologists Claude Steele and Joshua Aronson, who described this stereotype threat. What is it, and how does it work?
Well, black folks are well aware of the stereotype that floats around in the environment that they're not as bright as other folks. And Claude Steele and Josh Aronson have found that this is a real threat to people. That is, they're well aware that the stereotype exists, and they're very much afraid of confirming it. And the kind of evidence we have that that's going on is if you have black kids write down their race before they take an IQ test, they do a lot worse than if you don't have them do that. In other words, if you make that salient. On the other hand, if you don't emphasize race and you don't even emphasize the IQ idea, you just say, here's a puzzle, and we'd like to see how you do on it, they do a lot better. And these are things that don't have effect on white kids, but they do on black kids.
Do you think there'll be an Obama effect that might correct that a little bit?
Well, actually, I know a couple of black social psychologists who tell me stereotype threat is over because of Obama. I mean, Obama is clearly one of the smartest people anybody ever encountered, and that may do the job by itself. I'm not so sure, but I'm sure that it will have an effect.
You write that just telling students that their intelligence is under their own control improves their effort in schoolwork and performance.
Right. Aronson and a social psychologist at Stanford named Carol Dweck have both done studies where they basically start out with a premise for kids, look, your intelligence is under your control. They show them how the brain operates. They show them pre and post pictures of what the brain looks like, and are able to show nerve fibers growing toward one another in the learning process. And you convince kids that hard work will make them smarter, and sure enough, it does.
Another study you cite is by Daphna Oyserman, a social psychologist at the University of Michigan, who asked inner-city junior high school children in Detroit what kind of future they would like to have, what difficulties they anticipated along the way, and how they might deal with them, which of their friends would be most helpful in coping.
Right.
What were the results?
They were big. They were on grade point average, they were substantial, and they were huge on retention and grade. They were much less likely to be held back if they'd been exposed to that at the beginning of the year.
Some parents might be upset by your claim that IQ scores improve in kids who play video games.
Right.
All games or only the ones where you have to kill a lot of people to get a high score?
Actually, not by any means all games. It turns out some games don't do a thing for you, and some games really do. They work on fluid intelligence, these games, or what are called executive functions. And executive functions include the ability to inhibit wrong responses, to be able to stand back a bit, look before you leap, attention control, that is, knowing what to pay attention to and being able to keep your focus on that, and working memory, that's the ability to hold in your mind at the same time lots of different facts that you need to manipulate in order to be able to solve a problem.
You talked earlier about black kids being given puzzles. Why do you think that black students perform better on exams when they're presented as a puzzle rather than as a test of academic achievement or ability?
Well, it makes an end run around this stereotype threat. They don't have to worry about whether they're going to be shown to be intelligent. This is just a puzzle. It's not some kind of test of how smart they are.
Are you advocating more and different teacher training for dealing with underprivileged students?
A lot more research needs to be done on that topic. Teacher certification is no guarantee that a teacher is going to be better. In fact, there's no difference that we can tell between a certified teacher and one who's not certified. Higher degrees don't seem to matter. But we do know that the teacher matters, especially the first grade teacher.
So that sets the foundation for everything that follows. Okay. Not pre-K, it's the first grade teacher.
Well, probably pre-K is important as well, although we don't have the evidence one way or the other about that. But one study that's just very striking looks at kids in the kindergarten situation who are expected to have difficulties in the rest of school, either because the kid acts out, it just doesn't seem to fit very well in the classroom, or because the parents are very low education, low occupational status. And if you look at a kid who's been put into a classroom with a teacher who's been assessed as being at the top third in the school versus one who's in the bottom third, you get a huge difference. The one in the top with the teacher in the top third does as well as middle-class kids who've presented no problems in kindergarten. And if they get somebody in the bottom third, it's a bad prognosis for the kid.
Well, one of your most encouraging findings is that late interventions can also have an effect.
Yeah, this was a surprise to me as I was doing research for this book. I mean, basically, interventions at every age make a difference.
As late as the college years?
Absolutely. Even later. Actually, one of the most exciting things I found out, because I'm not getting any younger, is you can start exercise in your 60s and substantially reduce the likelihood of Alzheimer's. Or backing it up to the very beginning of life, if your mother exercises a lot when she's pregnant, you're going to be a bigger baby with a bigger brain, higher IQ. These kids have a much better prognosis. And then first thing after birth, if the mother breastfeeds, that's worth something on IQ.
Have you been following what's going on in Washington with stimulus money? Are you happy with what you're seeing?
Well, I was very happy until you told me earlier that apparently the education portion of the bill has been eviscerated.
Well, in the Senate bill, as far as I understand.
Right.
And who knows what will happen when they work things out with the House. But my sense is that education has been given shorter shrift in the Senate approach.
Well, of course, I think that's very sad.
Well, what would you like to see that money spent on?
First of all, I'd like to see it spent on research. We don't know that. Education research, frankly, is not very good in general. There's not enough of it. It's not terribly high quality. We do have some high quality research. We know about these excellent pre-K programs. There's no doubt about those. What we don't know about those is how they scale up. That is, we know that pilot programs are extremely effective. How big can you make them? How many people are there out there who can be really good pre-K teachers? Can you take somebody with an ordinary education, with ordinary motivation, and make them effective in that situation? We really just don't know. We don't know what kind of grade school and middle school and high school programs are best, although we have some demonstration projects like KIPP, which are extremely impressive. Again, we don't know how those scale up.
Now, do programs like KIPP cost a lot of money to start up?
Actually,
is that part of the problem?
Actually, at the moment, they don't cost any more than ordinary school.
There's more days of school, so it's going to cost you more for teacher pay.
At the moment, not, because they get these young teachers who are incredibly dedicated. They pay them a little bit more than the public schools, but not much. But if you were going to have a realistic application of KIPP, you're not going to be able to get such super dedicated young people. The young people who are doing it say, you know, I can't continue this forever. They know perfectly well they're going to blow up if they keep doing that. I've actually estimated the cost of KIPP quality education for every kid in the lower one-third of socioeconomic status would be about $35 billion. That would be a fantastic investment.
Richard E. Nisbett is a distinguished university professor at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. His latest book, Intelligence and How to Get It, Why Schools and Cultures Count, is published by Norton. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.